We do have the pleasure now to have panel discussion on urbanization, especially smart cities in Southeast Asia. And we also have the big pleasure of having three distinguished speakers, panel members who will be contributing their thoughts. Each one will be speaking for 10 to 15 minutes, and we'll be strict again with the time in order for us to have more discussion time during Q&A. We do have the pleasure to have Dr. Soraya Ismail as the first speaker, who is Director of Research in Khazanah Research Institute in Malaysia. Before joining the institute, she was Program Director at Think City, which is a city-making initiative of Khazanah National Berhad, where her role involved developing urban regeneration initiatives through a public grant program in KL, in Kuala Lumpur. She has previously served as Deputy Dean of the Faculty of the Built Environment at the University of Malaya, as well as Head of the Department of Quantity Surveying. We also have the pleasure of having second speaker, Ms. Elisa Sutanujaya, who is the Executive Director at the Rujak Center for Urban Studies, which has been carrying out a number of very interesting and insightful studies, very often in collaboration with international experts. Elisa is a trained architect, and she holds a specialization in sustainable and urban development and has been teaching in various universities since 2006. We have Mr. Renard Taipalki as the third and final speaker, who is with AECOM as a specialist. And before joining AECOM, Renard also has been working for many years with Asian Development Bank based in the Philippines. And in that regard, we have the pleasure of hearing about his expertise on the region, as well as various infrastructure projects that he would have been involved in, and also city urban projects that he has been working on. So without further ado, let me invite Soraya.
Thank you. Yes, I have some slides. 27, but it'll be 10 minutes.
Could we sit maybe there?
Yes.
So,
I can use anything as well. Thank you very much, Professor Hyun. And thank you for the Southeast Asia for inviting me to have to participate in this very important topic. And of course, provide some critical feedback on what ought to be the case when we talk about smart cities. Very grateful that Professor Lily has mentioned many overarching principles that of what a smart city is and the problems associated with execution as well as the definition of what being smart is. My experiences would be in terms of actually running the project of doing postmortems for smart cities initiatives in Malaysia. I'm also glad that she pointed out that cities are built based on historical narratives as well as new built cities. And sometimes, in order to make it homogeneous or have a homogeneous, sometimes certain new technologies would disrupt that historical narrative that made those places interesting and inclusive to begin with. So, with that sort of, I suppose, mukadima, you might know where I'm going with this. And of course, it is to go back to why cities are made for us. It is the pursuit of the common good. But before that, let me just enthrall you with some of these very nice photos, GIS mapping that we've done for a project for the government of Malaysia in a post-mortem study of Kuala Lumpur and Putrajaya, the new administration city of Malaysia. Why I chose Putrajaya and Kuala Lumpur, or the greater Selangor, is because these cities, or these hierarchies of cities and urban centres, contribute to about 40% of our GDP. So, This is technology. I can't see it. Sorry. There you are. So we start in 1857. Here we have a few towns. This is what it looks like. This is the old Kuala Lumpur. It is at the confluence of the river. And when the British came in, they saw that this is a lucrative tin mine. And therefore, they built infrastructure facilities to then bring the things that they mine in old Kuala Lumpur to the port city. So it became something like a way in which commerce was the forefront of why they want hard infrastructure to be built. And we see settlements being built along that railway. After that, we had roads depicted by this. This is how it was before. It has potholes then. It has potholes now. But our roads are bigger. So that was basically the creation of settlements and cities due to this export-orientated colonialism that came into being before we got independence. And of course, these new centralities brought with it more densification of these urban centers, which and then I forward it to 1982, where we have all these urban centers being concentrated at this commerce route. Now, after that, if we look at the splintering of urbanism, if I'm glad that Professor Lily brought that back, there were also other infrastructure that was being built. And then after that, they wanted to build Putrajaya. Putrajaya was not part of that going to the left, but it was going down, vertically down. And therefore, this is a new centrality that the government wanted to create away from the old route. And we have the new administration capital. Purpose made, same like your Canberra, but done in such a way that it must also show the accomplishment of Malaysia. And to that, the MSC, the digital infrastructure, was done that way. So this is planning of spatial planning of cities and how it has created different routes and different centralities or different settlements based on many many ideas and many direction, partly commerce, partly because you wanted to reduce the densification of that route, and also to create a new settlement because so many people were coming in. Inward migration into Greater Kuala Lumpur, which now, as I mentioned before, generated 40% of our GDP of the country. So this is how it is now, 1997, new centralities. I put there CPU for, that is the what we call the administration center. Some might say that this is not CPU, this is not the CPU of the city, but it is the direction of the federal policies on what ought to be the case for the creation of cities, the creation of jobs, and the creation of industries. And it's still central to, very near to Kuala Lumpur. And 2002, the CPU. And also we created more infrastructure roads. And this is how it is in 2025. They believe that the CPU or Putrajaya will be as vibrant as Kuala Lumpur. That is the aspirational document at the national level. Now, did we get local agency or participation in this creation of cities? So the past and the present. Historically, as I mentioned before, these are economic centres, commodities being exported back to the UK, Great Britain. Then MSC was planned away from the historic economic route, and therefore it did successfully create a new clustering of firms. Now there's a new wave. Why is there innovation in cities to be smart? Is it demand-led? Did the general public have a say in that they want this? Is there a choice? Is it industry-led? Is it firms just trying to sell their products? No offense to Ovarop, sorry. Or is it state-led, whereby you have to show that you're in this modernization track and wonderful things will happen to us if we modernize? And the other thing, because we actually do a lot of work at the neighborhood level, as well as there are centralities in even a big city. So this is what we look at as well, neighborhood or cities. And of course, in first choice, what if you don't want to become part of the smart city movement? What if you don't want to be homogenized in terms of ensuring that you will get the best efficacy of services? And most of the thing that was asked during our discussion with a lot of stakeholders in Malaysia, again, when we do focus group discussion, we democratize the idea of a smart city. Even in focus group, sometimes the loudest voice gets the hearing, though it might not be really representative of what the local community wants. So getting the right representation and filtering out the noises is also very important. And I think this is where technology can help. It's not the outcome of smart cities to have smart technology, but the process of ensuring it's democratized would be the role of technology, that I put that to you. So sometimes we do ask, when we move into a smart city platform, did it translate into A, higher returns to capital of cities? Did it make your city prosperous? And to whom? And consequently, better efficiency, better efficacy? And do we equate efficiency to livability? And that's why I wanted to bring the concept of improving the pursuit of the common good. Is there a better measure of livability? So you have all these gadgets around you, but did it improve the pursuit of your common good? Because in most literature, you can see that the future, what is the future, is aspirational, and it should have everybody thinking about the future of what is good for them. Now, what is that scale that you want to ask people what is good for them? Now, how do we invite participation, public discourse, pursuit of the common good? So a little bit of understanding of common good. I know you all very good university students and professors, but I'll just speak a bit. The motivation, okay, of course, it came with Aristotle. A good life is orientated to goods shared with others, the common good of the larger society of which one is part. So even the good is the same for the individual and the city. The good of the city clearly is a greater and more perfect thing to attain and to safeguard. So it's a collective. The attainment of the good for one person is to be sure a source of satisfaction, yes? Yet to secure it for a nation and for cities is a nobler and more divine. Again, context matters. During those times, you know, slaves are still there, and women are not supposed to participate in this future of what the city should be. But a polis, I'm assuming we will. This is something that all people in the cities fraternity would understand. It's an assembly of citizens engaged in a debate on how they should live together. So this is the real essence that I wanted to bring forward today. Fast forward, Rawls' pluralism of the contemporary landscape makes it impossible to envision a social good on which all can agree. And that's very important. So the intellectual and theoretical challenge to the common good today is the diversity of visions of the good life. And it makes it even difficult for people like city planners or city, people who talk about social justice. Impossible to attain a shared vision of the common good because such a shared vision cannot survive as an intellectual goal if all ideas of the good are acknowledged to be partial, incomplete, and incompatible. So it is a contested space, but how can we do this better? It is a contested space because you and I, what we think is the common good, is different. But let's look at the comprehensive end-to-end development. We did this with a municipal council. We have devices, you all know this. We have digital infrastructure administrator. In order to understand a common good, I present to you that administrators should have the capacity to analyze what is smart, what is needed at the local council. It must be at that level. So all you smart people here, don't go for investment banking. Go for serve the public life, administration, municipal council. Because you have very good consultants coming in, spieling, on what is the good, common good for your city. You must understand the local knowledge and understand the workings of your city and the constituents of people who live in your city to understand what is good or what is smart for your city. Preachy here, but I think it will work. And of course, the users of the smart city, it's not just about being the user, but also that you are part of the dialogue of what it is to have that future that you want. This is something that I feel that could sustain not just smart city, but any vision we have for a city, but with participation that is more helped or assisted by technology. And different stakeholders have different needs. I work in a social housing sector as well, and they can't understand all this. So sometimes when we explain to them what this might work, what might work or might not work, so that they are able to have a conversation with the municipal councils properly, it must be in a way that they can understand the graphics that we give them. So if you were to do A, B, C, D, this is what's going to happen. So this is very important in terms of making sure all socioeconomic groups in your city are able to participate in what is best for them using technology. I understand the issues of access, and sometimes it's expensive to put all this out, but I also agree that we need to be slow. Speed, rapid urbanization, everything that has rapid speed, I think is very bad, because we don't think clearly what we want for our cities. Sometimes it's good to just, take 2 steps behind, back, sorry, and understand what this means for our city. And striding into the future, this is basically a problem as well for local municipal council. You put this graph to them, they get so bewildered, bothered, and yes. Because it's not easy to manage all this. 1 minute left, the last one, this last slide. It's not easy managing this sort of future. Very smart people must be in local municipal council. To do the balancing act, and this balancing act is dynamic. People are transient in most cities, and to understand that the engagement is continuous, and technology could help. But technology that would also show indicatively what that future of the city would be for all. Currently, some, as rightly mentioned by Professor Lily just now, has been used as a procurement exercise. So I want to purchase this sort of cameras for this vendor. I want to purchase this sort of infrastructure for this sort of smart technology. And it's fragmented. It is a contract-giving type of facility because it's not the fault of the market, the private sector. It's the fault of the local municipal council. They don't know what they're looking at. And it's good to give that vision and for local participation to be inside the system of maintaining what is good for the city. Last slide. Size of cities and cultural economic heterogeneity, we need to keep that even if we go for smart city solution. Technology is to improve the public discourse. I think that is one thing that I want to bring back to draw upon the experiences we have had in Malaysia. Property rights and the hierarchy of public and private and public goods. The eclipse of the public, this I borrowed from John Dewey. And I think one of the issues is that most people have their plot of lands and they just want to build whatever they can to make as much profit as possible. And that profit motive sometimes goes against, of course, the common good. But I think when we talk about the common good, I love this Michael Sandel's work. We can know a good in common that we cannot know alone. So the positive experience of social interdependence enables person to learn from one another, thus giving rise to understandings of the good life that could not be envisioned apart from their own connection. We must build that social fabric first. And cities' initiatives that builds on that, I think in the end, will be sustainable. Whether it is reasonable to hope that adherence of different religious, it is a real thing, religious and cultural traditions, diversity can create lower tolerance. Lower tolerance could create friction. How do we understand people more? By having that common good, having discussion, living together properly. Identify aspects of the good life, a good life that are common to the lives of all human beings. And for that hope to be sustained, the creation of multiple ecosystems for public discourse and choices. I might not want to be in a smart city. And the public discourse is facilitated by technology. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we move straight to Alisa.
Good morning, everyone. So actually, I was pretty surprised when Professor Sin invited me to discuss about smart city, because our organization, Rujak Center for Urban Studies, and being a think tank that focusing on the urban and city region issues, we have a mixed feeling every time we talk and discuss about smart city, especially for Indonesia context. So this is a country which is consists of one province cities, which is Jakarta, 93 cities and 415 regions. Yes, it's big countries. So let's check if you want to know what is the current state of smart city in Indonesia. So if you Google image and Google smart city together with any Indonesian city's name, this is what you got. So first, let's start with Jakarta, Indonesia capital and home for 10.4 million. So back in 2014, this is the first city that launched smart city program with the support from various international organizations, which is included World Bank, the Ford Foundation, and HIFOS. But let me first warn you, if you go to the Jakarta Smart City website, you cannot access the website, because apparently they lock from the for the international audience. And then you have Bandung. He's a pioneer in terms of the futuristic design. And the former mayor was an architect, and he's kind of like a big supporter for Star Trek, and he became a Captain Picard in this room. So later on, the futuristic design became a trendsetter and a symbolism for next Indonesian cities who want to have a smart city program. Then you have Cirebon, which is my hometown, a city of 300,000 people. It's a secondary city. And then you have Malang, a colonial city with more than 50 universities, colleges and polytechnic schools, and population of 900,000 people, not including students. And then you have Manado, city of Sulawesi, nearby the Philippines. And you have Semarang, a city with a severe problem of the land subsidence and a capital for Central Java province, which is also having problem with the water scarcity almost every year. And then you have Surabaya, the second largest Indonesian cities, the capital of East Java. So apart from the futuristic room, Ibu Risma, the mayor of Surabaya, also installed 20 screens in her office that connected to 185 CCTV. And just a few months ago, she expressed her interest to adopt face recognition technology. And then you have Jambi, a capital city of a province that frequently suffer land and forest fire, including smog, which is become a hassle for Malaysia and Singapore neighbors. And then you have Makassar. This is quite funny. This is also one of the largest cities in Indonesia. June last year, the incumbent mayor disqualified from the mayoral election. his opponent accused him that he's trying to bribe because the mayor distributed almost 6,000 smartphones to the neighborhood leaders. And the mayor claimed that the purpose of granting the smartphone is to ease communication and coordination between city government and the head of the neighborhoods. And then I quickly show you another obscure city maybe you never heard of, Probolinggo, Cimahi, then probably you heard this one, Denpasar in Bali. So from 12 examples that I provided here, there are frequent words and certain symbols could be representation of smart city in Indonesia, which is our, I think you can guess, CCTV, application, and control room. And the national policy is under Ministry of Communication and Information. So the diagram on the left shows a glimpse of national policy of smart city concept, which is taken directly from the City Asia Report. It's become our national government policy. And last year, the minister, Rudiantara, announced that the ministry aimed to establish at least 100 smart cities. And last week, we have a new minister under the new cabinet. And when the journalist asked about what is the 100 smart city program, and Johnny Plate responded with three simple words, money, money, money. Furthermore, he explained that Indonesia needs lots of money in order to fulfill the target. And then not only government taking interest in smart city, the consultant also share common interests. For example, Jakarta Smart Safe City concept, which is facilitated by PricewaterhouseCoopers. The proposed program also suggests adding public CCTV from 6,000 CCTV currently to 70,000 CCTV. Then you have ADB, together with Future City Lab from Singapore, is providing technical assistance for Bandung. The World Bank is providing 50 million loan to Indonesia to develop national urban development project, which is heavily focused on how participating cities could carry out integrated planning and prioritizing their capital investments. One of the components of this loan is to setting up a city planning lab in collaboration with MIT. So let's now move to the reality on the ground. From the citizen point of view. So I would like to clarify here that I prefer to use word citizen, or we call it warga in Indonesian language. Perhaps it's come from Sanskrit, I don't know, rather than a people or residents. So because with citizen, you can have two things here. One is the legal consequences, as well as a state obligation towards them. And at the same time, a possibility of a direct democratic practice that could aim a different social life. So when you ask different groups and societies about what is their opinion about smart city, they would have various answers. So from Wi-Fi, yeah, it's a very simple one, to CCTV and apps, or Gojek, or Grab, or Uber, or whatever it is. What interests me is when I ask street vendors about their opinion to smart city, and the answer are not good at all. So here is the behind-the-scenes story why street vendors hate smart city. It's a problematic relationship. So in here is an Instagram story from Rama, which is a founder of Clue. Clue is a reporting app that gained its popularity back in 2015 after being introduced by Governor Ahok, which is a popular governor of Jakarta, as one of the smart city solutions for Jakarta. So in his story, oh, I just realized I make a typo here, sorry, it's supposed to be street vendor. In his story, he illustrates on how to use Clue. First, a Clue's user spot a street vendor, and then he reported. And within 1 hour, the Civic Order Police, or Satpol PP, came and asked the street vendor to move. Poor him, that's what Rama said. But it works, download Clue. It's available on iOS and Android. And suddenly, the smart city solution become a subjective tool for eviction and probably for expulsion as well. So if we believe a city is a oeuvre, or as Henri Lefebvre, sorry, my friend Sturble, wrote in his writing on cities, it is a production and reproduction of human beings rather than a production of objects. As I quote him furthermore, the city has a history. It is a work of history that is clearly defined people and groups who accomplish in this ongoing work in historical condition. So, and let me tell you another story about the production of space and of social relation that happened in one kampung in North Jakarta called Kampung Aquarium. It started with an empty sediment land, nothing, in the mouth of Ciliwung River. A marine biologist suddenly proposed a research center, and then it became an aquarium and a research center in 1939. And then he finally got funding from private donors and colonial government at that time. So after Indonesia proclaimed her independence in 1945, it only took 25 years from research center and an aquarium to slowly transform into kampung, a socially produced habitat which is some parties sometimes confuse kampungs with slums. It is a vibrant coastal kampung with mixed income and race, occupation, profession, a typical neighborhood where most urban majority live in Jakarta. So, and then suddenly on April 11, 2016, the kampung is gone to the forced eviction. It is a product of planning, product of smartness, that provide a justification for this eviction. And suddenly around 500 families lost their homes, history, and their vibrancy. It was an act of expulsion by the state, since those who resist also lost their access to public services, including ID card. So during 2015 and 2016, this is a happening years for Jakarta because we have 306 forced eviction happened towards street vendors and kampungs. However, for Kampung Aquarium case, the governor did not build any structure immediately after eviction. So when prominent archaeologists asked the governor not to continue with clearing up the site, apparently since they found some damages on the 17th century colonial wall, which is located nearby the kampung. But then, this is the smartest thing from these people who are trying to survive. The former residents returned to the site, despite its harsh condition, and rebuilt their life. Coincidentally, it was almost election year, and together with various organizations, including Grassroots Urban Poor Network, including us, they try to reclaim the kampung and livelihood. Through social agents, action and tactics, consolidation and networking, advocacy and campaign, no one's health condition, emergency force efficient like this, gradually transform into better condition like this. So starting in the beginning of 2018, residents who were holding their ground after eviction currently living in the temporary adequate shelter, which is include clean water, sanitation, and electricity. So this better and progressive state of Kampung Aquarium can be achieved by tapping into socio-political situation such as governor election. So once considered as a clientelistic approach, Kampung Aquarium and 24 kampungs proposed and signed political contract with one of the candidates, which is Anies Baswedan, and to campaign for Anies not only in their district but also other district. And at the end of the day, Anies won election by 58% vote. So the story of reclaiming and rebuilding Kampung Aquarium is the story of urbanism itself, a socio-political reality made up relation which is hard to be conceived of, restructed, and restructed by thought. So the vision of Kampung could not be decided or planned by, for example, in this picture, it's just a joke, two Japanese, one Taiwanese, two Indonesian architects who got nothing to do with the Kampung Aquarium. The vision of rebuilding Kampung is a collection of collective action and ownership that is produced consciously by its residents. But for clarification, this image is just only for visualization purpose. So the relationship between Kampung Aquarium resident and us, so-called experts, are equal. We start with the assumption that citizens are, as local resident and community itself, are city experts, at least to their own neighborhood. An example of this assumption, we organized a field school in Kampung Aquarium. An understanding of the origin and cause of the change raised the hope that further change can be directed toward good cause, that's what we believe, either by personally turning to values or circumstances of the past, or by absorbing new possibility wisely and critically. Interestingly for us, every knowledge and action produced by collective action, it triggers, sparks new possibilities. I think that's something that cannot predict to any smart city system. The process of rebuilding Kampung Aquarium involves a collective intelligence. not only from its residents, but also as a production of interaction from people and organization outside of kampung. This is what we call subjectivism in the formation of cities. Everyone certainly has the right to play an active role in shaping their habitat. It's a totally different story, a totally different subjectivity from the example of the clue that I give you in the middle of presentation. So in conclusion, I will be on time since I got 2 minutes and I only have one paragraph to go. The idea of participation, visioning, and integration in the Indonesia context of smart city is only become an obsession, but never really genuinely materialized. So for me, smart city is another product of planning as technique and ideology in response to demands arising from self-produced crisis. However, transformation offered by smart city always remains superficial, consumptive, and sometimes cruel. So far, smart city only become a contestation for urbanity itself, rather than a form of collaborative platform with its urban majority. So it failed to address and maintain social production and its relation, which is the essence of the city. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Renard.
Good morning, everyone. When I got the invitation from Professor Shin to speak today on the urbanization panel and the overall topic was smart cities, I thought I didn't really want to talk about smart city projects or smart city planning. That's why I chose rather this idea of smartness in a sense of how can we do better ways of urban planning to address urban development challenges in Southeast Asia. So I thought I'll pick 6 broad themes, which you are very well aware of, that they are urban development challenges in Southeast Asia, but also across the region. I don't think they are distinct just in Southeast Asia. And what I wanted to do is I pick each of those themes and I'll offer a couple of solutions. And some of these you may see in direct relation to smart cities or smartness, and others being much more basic or general approaches to better urban planning. To start with unplanned and rapid urban growth, I hope it's not too small, but what you can see in the upper chart is the growth of natural cities beyond administrative boundaries, therefore creating challenges to city governments who don't have sufficient financial resources or capacities to actually provide urban services for the actual urban area, which is far beyond their cities. And the lower statistic, you can see that Southeast Asia has never been very good in planned urban growth, planned urban expansion, and the degree of this planned urban growth has even decreased over the past 25 years. And this is an interrelationship of where do people find jobs, where do firms want to move, how do you provide different transportation modes for this mobility of goods and people, and how do you correspondingly allow land to be developed for residential uses or for other uses. And 3 solutions that I picked are not very much linked to smart city projects, which is the provision of trunk infrastructure in a much more scaled up way to provide more affordable land, particularly for housing development. The second aspect is to facilitate administrative processes, regulatory frameworks when it comes to housing codes, to building codes, which are often detrimental, for instance, in terms of maximum allowed density in neighborhoods. And lastly, this idea of collaboration between different administrative units, which is obviously a big challenge. There's little smartness in various solutions to it, but it's still one of the key challenges, and we heard it earlier about the case of Singapore versus the other cases in the Smart Cities Network. Coming to the second theme of underperforming assets, I think this is a very crucial concern, and I picked 3 recent examples here, one for underperforming waste management on the right-hand side, then on a current water shortage in the Philippines, and a power blackout, I think, about 1 year ago in Jakarta. And the issue we are facing in Southeast Asian cities is often not necessarily the lack of infrastructure. There is a big lack of infrastructure, but the key concern is how the current infrastructure is being managed. And there are some elements here which are, I think, more typically associated with smart city tools or instruments. Let it be, for instance, the more targeted use of resources. Where do we channel electricity in a wider electricity network? Or how do we use water across the city? And how do we design our infrastructure systems in a more resilient way? Meaning when you have natural disasters or other disruptions, does it lead to a blackout, just as in the case of Jakarta, or is the system able to withstand those disruptions and still function? So I think there are ways where possibly the typical command and control center comes into play, power utilities, water utilities, overseeing their network, understanding when to take actions, when to repair certain parts of the network, and how to schedule their maintenance. But there are also a range of aspects here which are more linked to general urban management aspects, which I'll pick up on a later slide. Coming to the third area, climate change and natural disasters, we all know that Southeast Asia is a hotspot with regard to a variety of possible and already existing climate change impacts. And I think this is an area where in our own work, we do indeed make a lot of use of smart city related tools. And this is primarily linked to communication and to data. When it comes to communication, there are now really a variety of channels we can use to communicate information about different climate risks to different user groups. And these user groups are also able to communicate back, for instance, to their city governments, valuable information. So I think this is an area where various smart city solutions do show some promises. They are also crucial when it comes to the general understanding and assessment of potential risks and impact. So informing city governments in their urban planning, deciding on where to open up new areas for development, which infrastructure to build to which standards, is pretty much a very much engineering exercise, but it's one where increasing data availability and smarter ways of using the data indeed help to invest money more wisely in the right type of infrastructure. Coming to the fourth theme that I've picked, and this is maybe the most intricate one, is about the ways how urban planning takes place in different Southeast Asian countries, and I think there are quite big differences depending on the planning traditions in those countries, and also the capacities that we find in municipal governments. And I chose two pictures here. The right one you may recognize from the previous presentation, that's the control center in Bandung, and the left side is Iskander, Johor Bahru, just opposite to Singapore. And I chose those two examples because on the right side, Bandung's former mayor, now the governor, did not only install that fancy monitoring room, but there were a range of initiatives to reach out, for instance, to entrepreneurs to facilitate the registration of startups and small businesses, to have reporting apps on dysfunctional infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So there was not just this control room, but there were different channels that were being used to kind of make a better link between citizens and businesses and the government itself, which I think is one example of this idea of communication in smart city instruments. On the left-hand side, Iskander is, I think, currently being supported through a UK development project in the range of smart city solutions for traffic flows and, I think, for low-carbon development. Now, the project itself is quite a good initiative. However, the problem is with the overall plan for the area. Iskander is about three times the size of Singapore. There's quite massive opening up of land, which is heavily based on foreign direct investment. And the way how this land is opened up and the scale of the opening up and the infrastructure that's being built there is mostly focused on car-centric, real estate-based urban development. So urban areas are being built there in a way that is not very efficient, that is not very sustainable, that is not very inclusive. You end up with problems such as traffic, for which you then try to get a smart city solution to manage your traffic, even though just 1 or 2 years back you yourself planned your city that way. And I think it's an unfortunate example of maybe being a bit slower, taking the time, opening up areas incrementally, and thinking about what the implications of the urban layout is on how your city functions. And so looking at some of the potential areas where urban planning can improve, if we take, for instance, the far left one on the multi-stakeholder approach, that city governments acknowledge that they do not always have the full capacities and allow citizen groups or private sector actors to come forward with ideas, even if these ideas are only for certain neighborhoods or for small areas in urban planning, urban management, to allow them to have more role, not just as a participant in a publicly run workshop, but also as a driver of their own projects. We have an aspect here which I noted as institutional culture, institutional change. Obviously, there's little use of introducing some fancy new technology if the different municipal departments are not yet collaborating with each other or they don't want to share the data with each other. And I think that's also linked to a differentiation between digitization and digitalization. In many municipalities, not just in Southeast Asia, but also, for example, in Europe, it's still pretty much a topic of taking information that's on paper and digitizing it. And that's the first important step, but that doesn't really help you to inform decision-making based on better digitally available data. So the step of digitalization is thinking about, you have all this data, how can you organize it, how can you filter it, how can you search for specific pieces of information, and then inform the way how you do urban planning. Moving on to the aspect of unequal access and affordability issues, just one example here from a recent study by the Asian Development Bank on housing affordability in 211 cities in Asia and the Pacific. Even if it's very small, the main message is it's incredibly unaffordable, no matter if it's just the primary cities or the capital cities, but even the secondary cities and the smaller ones are basically unaffordable for a large majority of citizens. The result of this is they have to move out of the cities, there are long commutes, there's more traffic, there are high household expenditures for the commute, etc. And so this is an existing concern in Southeast Asian cities and one that is also increasing. And I put a couple of solution areas here, but I'm not necessarily happy with them, which is why I put the question mark there. Yes, there are some innovations that we are seeing, for instance, using prefabricated buildings, which can help to lower the housing prices, which may allow for lower cost housing provision. The area of fintech and e-finance has helped to expand financial access and banking to lower income communities. There are various apps that have helped citizens to be better informed when it comes to mobility or purchasing goods and services from the most affordable sources. And again, trunk infrastructure plays a big role when we look at affordability and access. But I don't think yet that when we think about urbanization and smart cities in Southeast Asia, this is one of the weakest areas where we have not yet figured out how to use certain solutions to address increasing inequalities. The thematic area six that I chose is a rather big one, and I won't go into the details. Economic transformations are happening in Southeast Asia. They are very much urban transformations. We have the 24/7 business outsourcing industry, such as in the Philippines. We have some interesting examples of hackathons and other engagement activities where citizens and private sector actors help to come up with ideas that public administrations try to solve, but we also have another aspect of the labor market in Southeast Asia, which is migration between rural and urban areas, between cities as well as between countries. And then thinking about, okay, what are potential solution areas or things that we have to address? I think digital literacy is of a key concern to help to not have kind of, to leave no one behind would be too high of a motto, but at least to allow more people to benefit from different offers that are out there. And I think later today we have also a colleague who is quite specialized on this aspect of digital literacy when it comes to children or other groups in a city. Maybe to add one more thing is, in larger economically driven smart city projects, there is a certain risk of focusing on individual sectors. And when the economy in those sectors turns, that has huge implications on lower tax incomes and higher unemployment. So it makes sense to diversify your focus even in services that are focused on digital areas. And I think it's also fair to acknowledge that besides the services sector being a key driver in the urbanization in Asia, we still have the agricultural and manufacturing sector, which employ large amounts of people, and there are certain benefits which are still there and which can help people to get a decent income and livelihood, let it be in ecotourism, organically farmed produce, or sustainable manufacturing. And I think we should not disregard those areas just because some service industries are fancier or nicer to work on. Lastly, my conclusion slide, I have two elements here. One is when we look at smartness or smart solutions, and I put those both in quotation marks because they may not be smart, or you may debate what the smartness about them is, and you can also debate if they are actually solutions. I think at least from a methodology point of view, it makes sense to look at, do the improvements or the benefits that we expect from a solution lie in its design? Is it the way it is used? Is it maybe the way how service providers are utilizing a certain technology? Or is it the recipients or the users? And I think it makes quite a difference. Ideally, a solution addresses all of these areas, but often I think there is a singular focus on only one specific aspect here. And then lastly, and I took this from a paper that I published last year on certain smart urban data applications, is the key, I think, lies not in focusing on new capital infrastructure and how new projects are being built. They are important, but there is a huge issue with underperforming assets, the current management of cities. And if cities, even those with low capacities and little finance for new projects, can fix the way how they manage their current assets, there's much expenditures to be saved, and there's also a chance of improving the services to citizens and businesses. The second aspect is the 40% solution, or you may say a solution that is not as shiny or as perfect as in the catalog. And I think it's worth to rather move ahead when one works with municipalities and to figure out a solution that tries to kickstart a process, and along the way you incrementally improve it, even though it doesn't look as nice to present or it doesn't make for a nice newspaper article or something. And then lastly, politics of planning. I think we need to acknowledge that no matter how well designed a smart city project may be or an urban planning intervention, at least in my experience in a range of projects, it comes down to a lot of local politics, which is okay, and that's actually good, especially in those countries where you have a very vibrant democratic system, but it needs to be acknowledged that your plans do not just have an implementation timeline which completely ignores, for instance, electoral cycles or certain preferences by different electoral groups. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Renan. Can I ask all the speakers to come to the front? And we have the Q&As for the next half an hour, or a little less than half an hour, so that will give us plenty of time to have discussions. Okay, in the similar way, can I, perhaps we can perhaps collect in a couple of questions. And by the way, speakers are also more than welcome to ask each other questions if you are not happy with any of the remarks being made. So, yes, we have one in the third row.
Thank you so much, speakers, for that interesting presentation. My name is Isabel. I'm an Academy Associate with Chatham House. I have a question, perhaps mostly for Bu Elisa, about the moving of Jakarta to Kalimantan, and whether it's possible to foster Jakarta as a smart city, given that it's growing in complexity and sinking, and how do you start a smart city from scratch in Kalimantan? And also, what smart solutions are there to solve pollution in Southeast Asia? Thank you.
Pollution?
What was the last one?
The last one?
Two questions. The second question was about whether there are smart solutions to address pollution in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Any other question? Yes.
Hi, this is predominantly aimed at the last speaker. And I was just interested in how throughout your talk was the idea of the citizen. And we know from sort of other patterns of technical advance that often it's the non-citizens or the non-documented or the people in the hazy ground between being documented and undocumented that are largely excluded by these projects. And I was wondering what is in place to mitigate these kind of exclusions. Thanks.
I guess those two or three questions in total can be applicable to all the speakers. So who would like to have a go first?
So the first question is about moving the capital and how to install the smart city. Is that correct? Okay. That question is supposed to be answered by the National Development Ministry, which is handling the moving the capital. But from what I know, that they choose McKinsey to install the first smart city network there. But apparently, for my case, I don't think the moving the capital will be going to happen. Will going to happen or to be materialized, because again, there's too much complexity, not only about the city itself, but the nature of our politics, our Indonesian politics. Because the idea about moving the capital has been like, I don't know how many years, maybe 40 years, by different carried by, I think almost by all presidents, but they always come out with one thing that for me is quite funny. Every time we need some kind of like a diversion, the issue always come up. So again, it's mostly more like a political thing rather than necessity. Necessity, again, it's not about addressing the land subsidence. It's not about addressing the water scarcity. It's all for me, it's more like a political reason, and also in order to move the economic capital or whatever it is. And the second question about the pollution, how to tackle the pollution, because it's quite for me it's quite funny question. If I may answer on that, currently I'm one of the participants of the civic for the citizen lawsuit to the national government and provincial government, including three ministry, three governors, and also the president itself. So that's how we address air pollution. Because we want the government to act. We don't want them to stall the progress. We don't want to keep using the coal plant as a source of energy. So as a way for us, it's a smart thing to do. It's a smart and collective things to do as a citizen, to sue our government to do better in order for better future, not only for us, but also for our children. So I guess that's also answer to your question.
I'll tackle the issue about pollution, where one is congestion and two is the creation of buildings in our part of the world that's not based on tropical design. So basically creating a problem of building, creation of buildings that's not right for our climate. And buildings are the highest CO2 emission in our country. So that's one. So stricter green building plans are being in place now in most cities in Malaysia. Sorry. And the other thing is about congestion. When I compare the legalities that support your structure plan, the UK structure plan, the Singapore structure plan, and the ones that we have in our country, ours is a guideline. And therefore, when the legality is not as strong. So if private developers were to then create a densified mixed development, and the roads, our existing road structure developed by the state or the government, cannot then accommodate this, it creates a lot of congestion. And this congestion is because the private interests cannot be curtailed by our structure plan. And this is something that I'm actually working very hard to put more teeth into our structure plan in terms of legalities. And sometimes, rather than solve that problem at the root, we then create our MRT, alignment of trains and whatnot. And that is also a public-private problem, because in your country, you do it underground. In our country, we do it on top of the ground because of the limestone caves that we have in topographical nature of our Kuala Lumpur. Now, the alignment of these trains does not follow the conurbation of household, where they work, where they live, and leisure. So it is basically saying that the alignment of city-making, cities, settlements within the city, as well as public infrastructure, is not done properly. And that creates a problem more than, you know, if a smart city were to come in, it will not solve that problem. So we need to get our act together to really get this right.
Thank you for the two questions. The first one, I fully agree with the building standards, and I would say the enforcement of building standards should be particularly stricter for higher end developments. If you look at cities like Jakarta or Manila or Kuala Lumpur, it's not really about enforcing building standards for lower income households necessarily, who already have an issue of affordability, but the prime large developments where you still find, for instance, single glass window, which shouldn't be allowed anymore. And obviously that's a huge issue with regard to energy consumption. Secondly, I would say working more with independent or microsystems when it comes to energy supply, which allows you to use renewable energy on a smaller scale, which can decrease the dependence on coal. And then maybe a bit more controversial, I would say there is a lot of roads that could be closed, not necessarily ring roads or other things, but in neighborhoods. And there are a range of examples of where such extreme measures have actually increased the livability in smaller neighborhoods quite a lot. Regarding the second question about non-documented citizens or citizens in informal neighborhoods not being part of such projects, I can only speak for the projects that I've worked on that usually as international consultants, I myself don't have to be too much part of a local consultation process in the sense of that we like to have local consultants or local representatives from community groups and to do the consultation interaction with local groups, and they are the ones who provide recommendations and insights instead of us through translation trying to figure out what those groups, for instance, would prefer. And I think that's why we are highly reliant on strong local consultants, and then it depends a bit on the city government or the client, let it be World Bank or others, if they support that approach. Or, and we also find it, that we have national or city-level governments who say we want international consultants, we want to hear the great big best practices, and that's our concern, and then we may have limitations in how far we can reach out.
The last comment does remind me of one particular encounter in Malaysia where the consultation was involving the local government kind of going through gatekeepers rather than, you know, reaching out directly to committee members, and therefore who put together the series of, you know, the members of those, you know, community members, and who are coming to be invited to consultation, and who are also influencing the process of selection of, you know, who's coming to the consultation space. I think those are also going to be very much inherent and embedded problems that we encounter, despite all the good intention that they may have. Yes, more questions. So one in the front row. And there will be another.
Hey, thanks for wonderful presentations. I'm Doyang, a research officer from LSE. I'm wondering whether any of you see any kind of possibility that this introduction of smart cities in the region can be triggered to bring more democracy or participation. Because I'm thinking this smart city has some kind of internal contradiction within South East or East Asian state, because while the state want to take control over technology and information, while this introduction is led by, I assume, global like companies like from Western countries, which actually opposed to what the state ideology pursue. So whether this smart technology can empower like local citizens or like more ordinary people can speak more or can work against what state wants to do, like as we see the case of like Hong Kong maybe. Yeah.
Okay, there's another question at the back, red white shirt. Yes.
Hello. Hi, thank you for the presentation. My name is Moise, and I'm a PhD candidate from King's College London. The first question I have is actually for Dr. Suraya Ismail. I mean, you mentioned about smart urbanism and common good, right? However, I feel like there's always this focus on West Malaysia all the time, Peninsula Malaysia. And then when you mention about the North Bornean territories, such as Sarawak and Sabah, I feel like there's always like a neglection about these two states, which were actually interesting. If you look at history, in 1963, they were the two richest states entering Malaysia, right? And then suddenly it became the least developed two states, actually, arguably. And then I was just wondering, how do you bring back to common good? And then the second question is probably to all of you.
Okay, the previous question was about, yes, how the smart city can be facilitating a greater level of dystopian society or Orwellian society, given the concentration of technology, I guess, and data in certain hands. Well, I guess these are probably, you know, all these questions are applicable, again, to all three speakers. So yeah. Perhaps, Suraya, would you like to take a lead?
Yeah, just thinking about the nature of a city. I think for first, general on the nature of city, and then I'll go to Sabah Sarawak. To my conception, I think after looking at readings and as well as the practical experiences of many cities in the world, a city, I think, ought to be a place for different economic strata as well as different beliefs, cultural or religious beliefs, to have a space in the ecosystem. So a truly inclusive city would have their own ecosystem for different types or pockets of community, and where they can live together and then achieve their own objectives. Now, a city that is not providing that options or choices is when people then go off to other cities that they think will provide them with those choices. The problem with that is that you really have to do a lot of work to understand what maketh your city and what sort of society is there, and to facilitate that growth in society that way. Very difficult, but I believe that is where I thought technology would help. And then secondly, in order to really understand, because at the end of the day, again, I would always emphasize on the process, not the outcome. The outcome of the city is a collective vision, but we don't put in place the process of actually achieving that and the ecosystem to achieve that, then we will not realize that future. And there is also the issue about someone coming in and putting that global future for us. And we have cities ranking that has variables such as private international schools, private hospitals, and therefore creating these enclaves of really global people coming in. And I think this can cause distress for citizens or non-citizens in the country of a lower income strata. But if you believe in the ecosystem of opportunities, this is something that we actually have to think about properly, because you can't push the creative class to come in, or you call them the creative class, right? That's one. So we are as good as the public discourse that we have in a city. I had this discussion really when I went to one of the university professors in Harvard, and he says that, you know, last time when Harvard was just a small, Boston was small, they thought that they knew what was good for their city or their settlement because all of them read enough books, know what's good for their people, and therefore made their choices of what their town ought to be like. But as they grow bigger, that skill is something that is not doable, and therefore the advent of technology could facilitate this. But again, it's not foolproof. Okay. Second one, Sabah, Sarawak. Yes, fortunately, you are right. I have actually no comment to that. Regional development in Malaysia is something we tried to do in the current budget, 2020. God, I don't like talking about budgets, but yes. We are now looking into decentralizing development, wanting to enjoy a balanced development, and therefore more are going to Eastern Corridor, Northern Corridor. Will it work? I'm not very sure. But there is a move to then put more money in other cities. But mind you, previously we went for this consolidation because we believe certain theories before, agglomeration, densification. I think it's time to theorize more about what sort of cities we want and to theorize more of what works for us.
Okay, so I will try to answer on the democratic issues, whether it's possible for a smart city could helping democratize society. So I don't want to use the term of smart city here, but I prefer to use a component of smartness, if I quote from him. So I can give you three examples. So usually inside the smart city, you have the open data platform as well, right? So it is start from my own personal experience during the 2014 election. This is the first election when all the voting booth data available for the public. So five persons, they try to use the data, and then we all crowdsourcing and also controlling and also see whether there is an error or not on the data or not. And then other people can also see the data and then input everything. So it's also at the same time, because it's 2014 is quite ugly election as well, during the presidential election. So one party said we won and the other party said we also won. So this kind of contestation can be resolved by this opening the data and by the citizen try to crowdsource and counting on the data itself. And the second one actually is about, I go back to the citizen lawsuit that I mentioned. The government has their own data. And then they always said, we are not polluted. We are not that polluted. But then we as a civil society, we install our own stuff, IoT or a sensor. And then according to the sensor, it said that it's polluted. And according to the to the World Health Organization. So we're using that a component of smartness in order to argue in the healthy and democratic and also civilized argument between us and the government. Then it also decreased the control of government, saying that they're the one who own the data, but we can also produce the data. Other thing is about urban agrarian reform that currently conducted in Jakarta. Usually the map only produced by the government. But then we also use a component of the smartness, which is drone. And then we use drone, but for our own benefit, and then to argue why the settlement have to be there, why you're supposed to grant a certain kind of land rights to this community rather than evict them and then moving them outside of their periphery of the cities and etc. And then to answer to the second question regarding the Orwellian state, as long as you have a strong civil society, I don't think the Orwellian state is going to be there in Southeast Asia. I have a strong belief in civil societies, and because it's a collective intelligent, collective action, they always all they you know, you see Hong Kong, then Jakarta also copy Hong Kong in terms of doing demonstration as well, and then they evolve along the way, and then they're doing at the same time, not only in one city, Hong Kong only one city, but Indonesian cities, you can have a demonstration, 20 demonstrations at one day. As long as you have the healthy civil society which is smart, which is connected, again, this is using the smartness as well. And then you don't, I don't think it's the Orwellian state is coming soon. We will be there, the civil society, in order to avoid that Orwellian state.
Okay.
I would start from the back with the question about a dystopian smart city vision. I would say we are already there. So the only question is who's doing it more? Is it more private sector companies or the state? I guess in the Southeast Asian case, probably still more companies than states. And the question is if governments would collaborate with those service providers, do we have a trust in the regulatory or legal systems that the governments will put the data to a good use or a better use, or will they just utilize it in similarly questionable ways? But I think the situation is still far more advanced than we may perceive it. Secondly, on the question of smart cities bringing more democracy, I'm not sure about the democratic element, but I would say there is a chance of more accountability at least. Of things being mapped out, of information being made available or linked with each other. To give one example from outside of the region, and I'm not saying it's a successful example, but if we take Johannesburg, where you have the spatial development framework, they linked the city budgeting to the social development plans, social and economic development plans, and mapped that through GIS, and were able to show where investments of the city go to certain neighborhoods for certain uses. And I think that's one way of helping to show how the agenda of the ruling majority, for instance, or of the government links up with certain promises and the financial flows into certain sectors or certain areas of the city. And I think this is a very helpful tool to see what the government is actually doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I guess time is reaching the end. Listening to the talks, one thing that came to my mind is the expression smart that has become very popular nowadays in academic circles as well as in business and policy circles. It's probably the most probably bizarre, ambiguous expression, especially as far as academic discussions are concerned. This is probably the least academic expression that has kind of captivated the mindset of many academic researchers who have to engage with this, because this is being driven in many spheres. And especially when you think of what is the alternative to not being to being smart, you're like, ooh, that's a, you can kind of think of the adjective that is having an opposite meaning of smart, and that becomes very strange. I think it's also interesting to think about the urban futures and how to make provision of services and infrastructure for the population who are in desperate need. I mean, this is obviously a great and very important area that we need to still address. I mean, it is still very much an equitable and socially unjust world that we are still living, and especially in many populations across the continent, and especially in Southeast Asia, still not having the kind of access to those services and infrastructure that are enjoyed by some, but not enjoyed by many others. And I think there is still a lot of scope to work. And this is where all this technological advancement becomes quite interesting, because of the way in which, as we many of us would understand, technology and science are not value neutral. I mean, these are very much going to be reflecting the need of those who have the resource and power to make greater influence on how technological advancement as well as scientific innovation are put into certain use, and here certain use would refer to certain territories, regions, sectors, neighborhoods, communities, and therefore whose views are going to be reflected in the use of these technologies that we refer to as part of smart technologies. I guess these are always questions that will come up. So without further ado, before thanking everyone, especially our speakers, can I just remind people that we have lunch break that will be until 1:40. So can I please ask everyone to return, especially those of you who are joining us for the afternoon, to return to this venue before 1:40 so that we can start at the right time. Can I please finish my reminder? We do have connectivity panel, which is going to be on the impact of Belt and Road Initiative on infrastructure and politics in Southeast Asia. We also have governance, this keynote speech, which will be going to address the topics of human rights as the foundation of good governance, visiting the ironies of the Philippine experience. And then finally, the governance panel discussion that will be looking at the electoral politics in Southeast Asia from grassroots perspectives. So those of you who are here only for the morning, thank you very much. Those of you who are here for the afternoon as well, please do come back by 1:40. And last but not least, thanks so much to all the speakers for their wonderful contribution to the debate.